CFA Institute supports WHYY, a global association of investment professionals. It sets the standard for professional excellence and credentials. The organization is a champion for ethical behavior in investment markets and a respected source of knowledge in the global financial community. CFA Institute, creating an environment where investors' interests come first, markets function at their best, and economies grow. To find a charter holder, cfainstitute.org.
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Ahead this evening, we'll look at how the Pennsylvania budget impasse is forcing layoffs at one Philadelphia-based community organization. First, Pennsylvania is testing its ability to overhaul fiscally distressed school districts with a drastic plan for Chester Upland in Delaware County. The crux of Governor Tom Wolf's proposal? Cutting special education payments to charter schools from $40,000 per student to $16,000. Details from WHYY's Laura Benshoff.
Pennsylvania school districts are supposed to pay charter schools what they spent, on average, for their own special education students. Michael Churchill with the Public Interest Law Center says that number is skewed in Chester Upland for several reasons.
So they got hurt twice because they have higher cost students and they pay more because it's not being divided by the actual number of students but by a lesser amount. And so Chester doesn't spend $40,000 per special ed student.
Common Pleas Court Judge Chad Kenny has listened to arguments from the charter schools on why they should keep getting the larger amount. For example, Chester Community Charter School CEO David Clark says the data and the self-reporting by schools can't capture all of their special education programs.
We have programs for children that aren't necessarily on paper.
Witnesses for the charter schools say the cuts will be devastating, but none produced evidence of actually spending $40,000 on each special education student. In fact, they reported spending less than $25,000 per student. About half of all Chester Upland students go to charters, a greater percentage than anywhere else in the state. Cutting special education payments would allow the cash-starved district to nearly erase its $24 million deficit. Chester Upland School Board member William Riley says he supports the state overhaul.
Charter schools are for profit. That's the problem. It's money, money, money.
A decision on the plan is expected in the next couple of days. For WHYY, I'm Laura Benshoff.
More than 1 year after the Philadelphia School District fired three principals in the wake of the statewide standardized test cheating scandal, those educators soon could be back on the job. As WHYY's Kevin McCory reports, arbitrators ruled that two of them should not have been fired.
Michelle Burns, principal at Tilden Middle School several years ago when the alleged cheating took place, has won a ruling reinstating her as a district principal. An arbitrator also sided with Marla Travis Curtis, formerly principal of Lamberton Elementary School, but she is to be demoted to assistant principal. In both cases, arbitrators ordered the district to provide back pay, adjusted to reflect a short suspension. It remains unclear if and where the principals could be reinstated. School Administrators Union President Robert McGrogan says the union and the district still need to hash out those details.
We're really in a limbo stage at this point where no final outcome had been determined.
The Philadelphia School District would not comment on the details of the case. It says it's still reviewing its legal options for appeal. The district terminated Burns and Travis Curtis in January 2014, along with former principal Deirdre Bennett. Bennett, who was on staff at Huey Elementary during the alleged cheating, lost her bid to be reinstated through arbitration. In Philadelphia, cheating investigations were split up between the state and the school district based on the severity of the suspicions. The state's Tier 1 investigations in 12 district schools are ongoing. So far, 8 educators have been criminally charged and stripped of their credentials. The district led cheating probes at another 19 so-called Tier 2 schools. Including Burns, Travis Curtis, and Bennett, the district has disciplined 15 educators, including firing 3 teachers. With these actions, the district says it has closed the cases connected to the Tier 2 investigations. For WHYY News, I'm Kevin McCory.
Patients with mental illness who died at a former Delaware psychiatric hospital were buried in unnamed graves. Only numbers mark their final resting places. From WHYY's Delaware desk, Mark Eichmann reports on efforts to match names with those graves so that the buried can be remembered properly.
Hidden away and long forgotten, deep inside the Delaware Health and Social Services campus near Newcastle, is a spiral cemetery filled with gravestones, marked with just numbers. There are more than 700 stones for former patients at the Delaware State Hospital. The hospital treated patients with mental illness, as well as those with developmental disabilities and other ailments.
The people who are buried here were formerly patients of the hospital who, when they died, either had no family or their family had no means to bury them.
Faith Kuhn is spearheading the effort to clean up the cemetery and make it more accessible. That meant ripping out the massive hedgerows that once surrounded the cemetery.
What you see today is a tremendous improvement over what it was in 2010.
It's come a long way. Back when I first started here, we had a hedgerow, poison ivy grown up all around the area here, and it was not even noticeable from the street.
John McDermott has spent more than 30 years working at the DHSS campus, which includes the shuttered hospital and the modern Delaware Psychiatric Center.
We came in and we had our crew and some contractors take it all down and clean it up. We've raised the trees here a little bit so you can see some of the stones. So we've come a long way with it.
Now that the cemetery is visible, there's an effort to give dignity to the people represented by the numbered stones.
We have people that come here and visit, and we also have people from the campus that like to walk. They'll come up here now because they see it.
But even seeing the stones doesn't provide any information about the lives buried below.
The name of the person was recorded in a cemetery book. And the cemetery book for this cemetery resides in the Delaware State Archives.
Everything is in a name. That's the beginning of my identity. I'm not just some person who has a mental health diagnosis. I am Bryce. This is me.
Bryce Hewlett leads the Delaware Consumer Recovery Coalition, a group dedicated to including and integrating those living with mental illnesses into society at large.
Just being able to put the names of the people who have passed away and are now buried here in a place that's recognizable is very significant to bring dignity to the people buried here.
The project is really about recognizing those with mental illness who live quietly and largely unnoticed. He says the only time mental health gets attention in the news is when someone injures or kills a lot of people, even though
people with mental health diagnoses are far less likely to be perpetrators of violence than they are to be victims of violence.
Next year, a monument listing all the names of those buried will be placed on the edge of the cemetery. That monument will be sculpted in part by people who live with mental illness.
It'll be a well-built structure by the folks at the Creative Vision Factory who have a lot of experience in creating monuments like this. This will be something that many of us in our community can always point to and say, you're not forgotten.
We believe that this is a very important statement that people who lived with mental illness and who suffered under the stigma of mental illness, this is in honor of them.
The monument is expected to be in place by next spring. From the Delaware Desk, I'm Mark Eichmann, WHYY News.
Taking a look at this evening's headlines, a man arrested for jumping a wall at the White House has been fatally shot after authorities say he attacked a deputy sheriff at the Chester County Justice Center. Chester County District Attorney Thomas Hogan says in a statement today that Curtis Smith was arrested at the White House in March. Hogan says Smith pulled a knife and slashed a deputy sheriff at the Chester County Courthouse around 11 this morning. He says another deputy shot Smith. The Coatesville, Pennsylvania man was pronounced dead at a hospital. The slashed deputy was hospitalized in stable condition. Smith was charged with unlawful entry at the White House March 1st. He agreed to stay away from the property for 6 months so that the charge could be dismissed. Pennsylvania Attorney General Kathleen Kane says she hopes that efforts to force her to release more pornographic emails discovered in state computers will be rendered moot by a high court decision on what can be released. Kane's statement today comes as she maintains that releasing the information will aid her defense against criminal charges that she leaked investigative information and then lied about it. Her office says it's worried that releasing some of the material could be perceived as retaliating against current or former members of the office who are witnesses against her. The Commonwealth Court has scheduled a September 16th hearing on Kane's challenge to the Philadelphia Inquirer's request for those emails. a $225 million deal between New Jersey Governor Chris Christie's administration and ExxonMobil over dozens of polluted sites and nearly 2,000 retail gas stations has been approved by a New Jersey judge. Superior Court Judge Michael Hogan ruled today in the 11-year-old case that spanned Democratic and Republican governors. Hogan says the deal is a reasonable compromise. Clear skies, 84 degrees on Independence Mall. It's 6:16. You're listening to Newsworks Tonight on WHYY. This evening's forecast, clear skies, low 62 degrees. Sunny tomorrow, Wednesday's high in the mid-80s. Still ahead, with Philadelphia's annual Fringe Festival kicking off next week, we're left to wonder, what happens to the shows after the lights go down?
Fringe was a single performance, and that sold out and was tremendously well-received by the audience. And then the thought was, this should happen again, that too much work has been put into this project.
Newsworks Tonight continues after this set change.
Hey, what's up? I'm Shad. Fat Mike is the frontman of the punk band NoFX. He talks about the 25th anniversary of his label, Fat Records, one of the most successful indie labels ever, and how he stayed fiercely independent throughout his career. That's coming up on Q from PRI Public Radio International.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
The car served me through college, grad school. It moved me from Minneapolis to Portland, Oregon, and then Portland, Oregon to Augusta, Georgia. And the Lumina is still giving by putting my favorite programs on the air. It feels awesome. My name is Bethany, and I donated my car to Public Radio.
Learn more about the WHYY Vehicle Donation Program. Call 855-WHYY-CAR or visit whyy.org/support.
Despite those new carbon rules from the White House, new coal mines continue to open up. The catch is that the coal isn't going where you'd think.
And all for the greed of the excuse that we need energy. Well, this energy is going to Mexico.
Yeah, I didn't see that one coming either. I'm Kai Rizdahl. That story and the latest from Wall Street, fingers crossed, next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Coming up next on WHYY.
Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. As the Pennsylvania budget impasse drags on, Governor Tom Wolf is under pressure to direct funding for critical human service programs. Philadelphia-based Congreso de Latinos Unidos works to strengthen Latino communities in our region. Let's look at how the impasse is hampering their mission with Congreso Chief Communications Officer Yvette Nunez. Yvette, thanks for joining us on Newsworks Tonight.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for having me.
I understand you were part of those efforts to impress Governor Wolf with the need to generate more funding. You were in Harrisburg today.
Yes, I was. I was actually joined by about 24 Congresso staff and clients, and we joined a group from PCCY that went to Harrisburg, had legislative visits, and also had a press conference encouraging the legislature and Governor Wolf to pass a budget as soon as possible.
How were you received?
By all accounts, everyone supports an increase in funding in education. Obviously, based on party lines, we kind of got caught up in conversations about everything else that is hampering the budget. But the most critical message that we had to deliver was that we are no longer talking about a theoretical impact, depending on how much longer it takes to pass a budget. We are already approaching September, and as of September 1st, Congresso staff and clients have to enact some really critical implications to our budget and how we do our work at Congresso based on the fact that we have yet to receive funding this fiscal year.
We are just 1 week out from September 1st. What actions will you be forced to take at that point?
Effective September 1st, all Congresso staff will receive a 40% salary reduction. In addition to that, we have 11 full-time furloughs and a number of layoffs. Since we are in the social services sector, obviously we have some staff who, with a 40% cut, are barely making more than the clients that come in to receive our critical services are making on an annual basis.
But with that cutback in salary, will you still be able to provide full services to those who you serve?
Unfortunately, we won't be able to provide full services, but our staff is as committed to meeting as many of the needs of its community as it can. So effective September 1st, we will have to reduce our after-school programs by about 46%. This affects 300 students who will no longer receive after-school services in grades K to 12. Now, remember, Congreso is situated in a neighborhood with the highest rate of high school dropouts. Latino males have about a 60% dropout rate, and our neighborhood high school has about a 38% graduation rate. So we know that after-school programs are critical to the community that we're serving, and this is a dire impact and an immediate result of this delay in passing a Pennsylvania budget.
Certainly when schools reopen later this month and next month, the impact will be felt across the education strata as well. But it's agencies like yours that have been the canary in the coal mine, as it were. Once upon a time, fairly recently, with a budget impasse, state employees were affected, but that's no longer the case.
Correct. It's a big concern, and that's part of what has driven Congresso to be so visible in how we have to respond to the delay in having a budget for Pennsylvania. We know for a fact that there are other nonprofits that have already executed layoffs. We know for a fact that there are other nonprofits who are struggling to make their next payroll or now determining whether or not they can carry their teams through September. We have been very proactive in doing our projections and performing due diligence to make sure that we could be accountable to our staff and to our funders and to our community for as long as we possibly can.
And as you cited the potential for 11 full-time furloughs, what percent of that staff does that represent?
That's about 8% of our staff.
A pretty big cutback.
It is, and specifically within certain programs, including our after-school programs, it's significant.
We share with you the wish that this budget impasse ends as soon as possible. Thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you so much, Dave.
That's Congresso Chief Communication Officer Yvette Nunez on NewsWorks Tonight. The annual Fringe Festival gets underway next week when more than 150 performance pieces are planned throughout the city. Some will be brilliant, some will not, and some will disappear as soon as the curtain drops. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports on the afterlife of the Fringe.
This is how a lot of artists approach the Fringe Festival. They put a great deal of effort into developing a piece, debut it at the Fringe, and then try touring it to other cities to extend its life. That's what Pig Iron Theater has been doing for many years, but this year, the company is working with the band Dr. Dog to create a performance that exists somewhere between a rock concert and experimental theater. The show is called Swamp Is On. It's an attempt to bring the audience into communication with another dimension. It's weird. But weirder still is trying to package the show for the road. Pig Iron co-founder Dan Rothenberg says this one may not have a life after the Fringe.
How do you cover your costs? And one of the things that is especially expensive, both in theaters and concert venues, is time in the space with technical people, the riggers, the lighting folks. So the question is, how can we take this concept and get more nimble so that instead of loading it in 2.5 days, can we load it in half a day?
Finding a life after the Fringe can be daunting. Last year, the artist Mary Mattingly built a boat that resembled a sinking row home. She called it Wetland, and it was moored in the Delaware River with floating gardens, a beehive, even a chicken coop. It was a homesteading experiment dressed as a metaphor for underwater mortgages. Since then, Mattingly has had to figure out the second act of her floating metaphor.
Right now we're in Westville, New Jersey at Bob Smizer's boat hauling. That's where Wetland has been stored.
After about 9 months in dry dock, Mattingly has lined up a few more gigs. Wetland will soon be towed up the Schuylkill River to the Walnut Street Bridge, where a group of students from the University of Pennsylvania will use it as a home base for environmental projects. Then it goes to the Parish Museum in Long Island, and then back to Philadelphia to Bartram's Garden. Mattingly is spurred on to repurpose her art project because she is liable for the upkeep of this big physical thing. It's not a concept. It's a boat.
A lot of the projects that I've done in the past have been temporary because we've had to rent something or borrow something and then at the end dismantle an ecosystem and spread it out to different people. Here we're able to keep building it and keep using it in different places.
Another project that debuted at the Fringe Festival is now getting its third and final act. In 2006, a band called the Valerie Project performed a live soundtrack to a surreal 1970 Czechoslovakian film called Valerie and Her Week of Wonders.
Fringe was a single performance, and that sold out and was tremendously well received by the audience.
That's the producer, Joseph Gervasi.
And then the thought was, this should happen again, that too much work has been put into this project.
So Gervasi took the act on the road. Greg Weeks, formerly of the band The Espers, wrote the music and led a band of 11 musicians to California, Canada, twice to New York, and once to the Royal Festival Hall in London. And then it just stopped.
The problem was that the Valerie Project itself was a behemoth. There's 11 people, two cellos, and this concert harp that needed its own van for touring. It was a tremendous hassle to do these performances and also to make any money from them because there was so much expense involved.
Now, 9 years after it debuted at the Philadelphia Fringe Festival, the Valerie Project has one last hurrah on DVD. The movie, Valerie and Her Week of Wonders, has been released on disc by the Criterion Collection. Curtis Choi at Criterion decided to add the Valerie Project as a DVD extra.
It has kind of a folk feel, very earthy, hypnotic quality, and their musical style, while being very different from the score, was in a certain way oddly appropriate.
Gervasi believes this is the best possible ending for the Valerie Project. The DVD was released in July. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Benyakov and Kimberly Haas with help today from Alex Lewis. Every August, the best youth baseball teams in the world descend on Williamsport, Pennsylvania for the Little League World Series. The nationally televised tournament draws thousands of spectators to the small town, and tomorrow we'll have the story of how the locals respond to the annual baseball barrage. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.